couple housekeeping items before we begin. DVDs are now available that have Ephesians, Philippians, Galatians, and Ruth. So all of those will be available as of tomorrow. So you can make your request with my illustrious wife. And what you see up here on the screen is a picture that I just received today. We always thought that this machine made its trip from California to Texas on two trailers. It made it in one trip. And I wrote a 30-page paper with 160 footnotes about this. This will soon be going on our website. And it's an interesting thing. We have some people from the Historic Construction Equipment Association that will link to our Christian website, Message of Life, as soon as we have some information on equipment there. So they'll be sending all their people who are looking for antique construction equipment to a Christian site. Well, RG regarded the real mountain mover as the Lord. Now, this is what the machine looks like today after it was reassembled. It was the biggest scraper of its day. It moved 12 yards of dirt, and the most anybody else could move was 3, and it only required one operator to move 12 yards. Everyone else who was trying to move 3 needed 2 operators. Same tractor would pull both machines. But I don't think you came here to learn about Letourneau scrapers. Somehow I've got that idea. Now this passage is talking about making peace. Now you might be wondering, when you look at a peacemaker like this, why I would put that there. Now notice, look at the last verse in our passage. Now the fruit of righteousness, verse 18, is sown in peace by those who make peace. Now, as I say, you might be wondering about this, but this bomber, known as the B-36, has a couple of unique distinctions. It's an absolutely huge plane, just absolutely huge. Look at all the engines on it. It's the biggest piston-driven plane that the U.S. ever commissioned and made multiple copies of. But this plane actually was indeed a peacemaker. It is far larger than the B-29, which was the one that delivered the atomic bombs to Japan during World War II. Actually, if we look at the next picture, you'll see a comparison. On the right is a B-29, which was the biggest American plane during World War II, and this was its replacement. The reason that this is as large as it is that it was designed to be able to fly across the ocean, bomb targets in the Soviet Union, and return. And so they needed to be able to carry a lot of fuel. It was in the period of time before they were ready to make strategic bombers that were jets. Indeed, when the B-47 jet came in, it didn't have the range of this plane. This plane served as a peacemaker. It is the only strategic bomber the United States has ever made that did not drop a single bomb in wartime. It was a truly successful plane. It kept the peace. It was replaced by the B-52. But when we talk about peacemaking, peacemaking doesn't mean that a person is a doormat. Peacemaking does not involve weakness. It involves strength. But one is to use that strength graciously. Imagine if during World War II the Germans or the Japanese had possessed a plane like this. A plane like this would have been used offensively in order to do all sorts of things, but the United States had it in order that it not be needed. Now, we all are familiar with the statement that Teddy Roosevelt made of walk softly but carry a big stick. And I thought for sure I needed to show you a big stick, besides the B-36. This is in Eveleth, Minnesota. This is at the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame, and it is the biggest hockey stick and the biggest hockey puck in the world. 110 feet long and 10,000 pounds. But carrying a big stick, but using it graciously, is the way that peace is made. Okay, let's do a review on the book of James. And we'll be getting into peacemaking from James's context. Now, last time we looked at James chapter 3, verses 1 through 12. Within the flow of this book, you remember the book starts out with the context of trials. These believers have been transferred, they've been moved from being in their comfort zone in Jerusalem to having to move out because of the persecution that developed in Acts chapter 8 after the martyrdom of Stephen. These people are unsettled in their circumstances, and there are many difficulties that they are facing, and they don't quite know how to do it in a gracious way. And as a result, the number of problems that are occurring within that congregation is far larger than the number of people that were involved in the congregation. They had problems galore. So we have the context of trials, and that becomes the focus of the book. How to approach trials so that we benefit from them and we are strengthened in our Christian way of life rather than blaming God for them and caving in on the trials. So James, in verses 2 through 18 of chapter 1, is looking at those issues. He's writing to believers, as we know from verse 18. Verse 19 tells us the outline of the book. Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. We spent time looking at the three subsections under swift to hear. He argued in the end of chapter 1 for believers to be hearers who do, who apply the word in order to receive the deliverance from trials that the application of the word brings. They were not to hold their faith with an attitude of partiality as they were discriminating against fellow Jewish believers who did not have their same economic status. And deliverance through applying the truth that we believe. That then prepared us to get into the section slow to speak, chapter 3, verses 1 through 18. Next week we will be entering into let every man be slow to wrath, and I didn't correct that. So let's review now what we saw in chapter 3, verses 1 through 18. Especially verses 1 through 12. Now, as we look at chapter 3, verse 1, it says, let not many of you become teachers. As we noted, it's really nice that he left the letter M in there. Of course, he wrote in Greek rather than in English, but he didn't say, let not any of you become teachers. The problem that we're going to see here within this chapter is that there were believers who were not yet mature enough to be in a position where they would be sharing from the word in their congregation. As they have been forced to move, we have people that are rising up and saying, well, I'll take the Sunday service, I'll take the Wednesday service. But some of the people who were wanting to speak were not people who had sufficient maturity to be able to handle that. And James is urging them not to be too quick to volunteer for that, not to be ahead of the timetable that God had set for them. What he gives as a reason for that is because teachers receive a stricter judgment at the Bema Seat. The reason for that is because A believer is responsible not only for what they teach, but for their own application in their own lives. Teaching affects other people, and someone has a great deal of responsibility, so therefore there is a greater level of scrutiny at the Bema Seat. That was the concern which he raised at that point. Notice in verse 2, he gives an explanation. For we all stumble in many ways, and notice he includes himself. He does not exempt himself. James does not see himself as not stumbling. And notice he speaks in many things. But he says, if anyone does not stumble in word, he is a mature man, able to bridle the whole body. All believers, including James, stumble in various ways, so the believer who can prevent himself from stumbling in what he says is mature enough to prevent stumbling in other areas. James has here given us a clue as to why he has set up his argument the way that he did. What's the outline of the book? Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Notice James is seeing our speech as a barometer of our maturity. He's saying that as we have our speech under control, it shows that we have sufficient maturity in the Word to be able to handle other areas of our life. What he's indicating is that the tongue is one of the tough ones. And I think we all can identify with that. James is saying that when we look for a measure of maturity, our tongue is a pretty good barometer. Wouldn't we like it if he had said the amount that we know of the Word is the barometer? That would have been easier. Because we find it easier to learn than we find it to apply. But James is telling us that the measure that God uses is the application of the truth that we have believed. Now, if we don't learn truth, if we aren't learning the Word of God, we can't apply it. But if we're learning and not applying, what did James tell us in James 1:22? That we are self-deceived. He said, do not be hearers only, but be doers of the word. And the reason that he gave was that we would be self-deceived. We'd be double-minded, thinking that we're pleasing God, but instead we're only pleasing ourselves. Notice that James has introduced the idea of horses and bridles and bits. Because what he has said here is that he is able to bridle the whole body. One is able to control their body in the same way as a horse is controlled by the bit and the bridle. I have a couple of additional pictures here, so I think you'll find this interesting. We have the horse here that the person is riding with a bit and a bridle, and then a close-up of that. And the bit will go in the mouth. It goes back far enough in the jaw that it's behind the teeth. Let's look at that a little more closely by looking at a dental model of a human mouth. As I pointed out, if you touch your teeth, you can press and go like this, and you don't, it really doesn't cause any pain. Doesn't cause any discomfort. But if you move back to where the jawbone, the lower jaw, goes like this, and you put pressure here and you move, you can feel the pressure. With a horse, the bit is going back far enough that it is in that area. Now, it's important not to be hard on the bridle and to really a heavy-handed rider is going to cause the horse's mouth to become what's called a hardened mouth, where they stop having as much sensitivity there. The light touch on the reins is that which will make it so that the horse is going to be responsive, because you're not wrenching there, but you're putting just enough to let the horse know what it is that you are wanting from the horse. But we saw that we also have the problem that is spoken of the horse taking the bit in its mouth, and that's where it shoves it forward and clamps down, gets it between its teeth, and then you can do anything, and the horse is not going to be affected by the bit. Now, God has a solution, and so does the writer. Now, what if we get the bit in our teeth? Well, God likes to use gentle reins if we are responsive to the Word. God is not heavy-handed. When you look at our Bibles, you see that God is a God of grace. And you remember how Jesus spoke of His burden being light that He gives to us. It's not the heavy-handed sort of thing that often happens within legalistic systems. But God and His Word are able to do something a little different with a believer who's starting to rebel against the Word. And lo and behold, James's group that he's writing to are going to experience God using the plow rein upon them. And so now I have to illustrate what the plow rein is. If the horse gets the bit between its teeth, clenches down, then the reins simply are not sufficient under the normal light control to bring about the obedience of the horse. So you might find this picture from 1892 to be rather interesting. You'll notice the woman on the right is drenched. She was just thrown by her horse that has no one riding it into the brook, and the stranger rode after it and came back with the horse and presented it to her, and then she said that she's greatly indebted to him, but could he please bring the horse to the other side of the brook? Well, let's take a little closer look at this. Notice that the rider has, in the one hand, the reins, and he's controlling the horse that he is sitting on. With his other hand, he has the reins of the horse that the woman was on, and he has pulled the horse's neck, or actually, because the horse was wanting to go in a different direction, the horse has left his neck facing towards the rider. Now here's what happens if a horse gets the bit into its teeth. You grab a hold of the bridle on the side of the head of the horse and you pull the horse's head around like the horse there on the right. So there that horse was with the bit in its teeth and it was running as fast as it could run. And just imagine, how fast is the horse going to run when you pull its head around? It can't see. And it's going to come to a stop. That is the procedure that is used. In other words, the rebellious horse is dealt with accordingly. Whereas the horse that is responsive to the reins, to the bit, receives the gentle touch. That's kind of how it works with the Lord. The Word is designed to deal with us in grace and kindly, with a light touch as we respond to the Word. But when we start getting the bit into our teeth and we want to run our own direction and we aren't going to let the Lord, through His Word, control us with the reins, He has to use the horse, the plow rein of getting a hold of the head, getting our attention, getting us to stop, and starting over. That's called discipline. Notice James is saying that the whole horse can be controlled by controlling its head, either through a gentle touch or through the plow rein. Then he moves on in verse 4, where he makes the point of the ship's rudder. And there, the ship's rudder is small, but despite being small, just like the tongue is a small part of our body that boasts great things, the rudder has disproportionate power, disproportionate to its size. So we have some pictures of some ships. At first, you'll notice the large sail on this Roman ship that was restored, or this is a model that was built of it. They have all of the parts that survived there in Mainz, Germany, and at this particular museum. And this was a Roman warship. Now we want to notice something that can be done with sails. I do recognize that the technology on sails is different than it was in the ancient world, but even then, they did have the capacity to sail somewhat against the wind. Now, what you do there is you change the angle that your sail is, and you use your rudder, and so on and so forth. You'll notice the wind is being depicted as going downward, but the boats are going towards the top of the picture. They can't go directly against the wind, but they're able to accomplish it by zigzagging. Now, let's illustrate it in a little different way. I made a mirror image of this particular man in a little boat with a sail. The red arrows that are at the bottom are showing the direction that the wind is coming from. As you notice, the sails are ballooning out towards the stern or the back of the boat. I mean, notice how the wind is blowing from this direction into the sails. And yet, what direction is the boat going? It's largely going in the direction opposite, that is, against the wind. And so you can see the direction that the boat is pointed, as illustrated by the yellow arrows. And essentially, what the pilot does is he revolves the sail around the two sides of the mast and is able to handle his boat accordingly. And he also has in his hand behind him, at the stern, he has a rudder. So he's able, by manipulating his sail and manipulating the rudder, to chart the course that he wants to take. And notice how James says in James 3:4, "Look also at ships. Although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires." The sails are large. The rudder is small. But the rudder is working in the water, and therefore, since it's a greater level of friction, a relatively small rudder is able to steer the boat. And so the lower red box here is illustrating the rudder itself from this reconstructed Roman boat. And then what you see in the upper part is where the pilot has his handle in order to be able to turn the rudder. For all intents and purposes, the rudder looks just like an oar that is stuck down into the water vertically. Let's look at that a little more closely. There is the rudder. It's relatively small in relation to the boat as a whole. But despite being as small as it is, it has great power. James is comparing it to the tongue in our mouths, that it boasts great things. So, everything that James is pointing out thus far speaks about the great power that the tongue exerts despite being small. And he goes now into speaking of its destructive power when he talks about it being a fire. And all it takes is one small spark, and you can have a huge brush fire, as is depicted here on the slide. And the brush fires can sometimes grow together so that from a satellite, they're able to see the smoke, and they put in the red here on these pictures to illustrate where the fires were up in Siberia. And this could be seen from outer space. And we know it only takes a small spark to get the whole thing going. And then we depicted the firecracker just at the moment of explosion. It doesn't take much to get the whole thing going. And so what James says in verse 6, "And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature, everything that we come into contact with, and is set on fire by Gehenna." Now, the reference to Gehenna there is the word Ge means valley. And it's the Valley of Hinnom, and that's within Jerusalem. This is what the Valley of Hinnom looks like today. But back in first century times, it was the garbage dump of Jerusalem. It was perpetually on fire. And it was used as a depiction of punishment after this life. And so Gehenna has been used as an illustration because of the fires that perpetually burned in the garbage dump. And James is saying here that our tongue entangles us in iniquity. Look at how it happens. We tell one lie, or we may misstate ourselves a little bit. And then someone asks us about it, and then we kind of cover it up with another little lie. And the lies get bigger, they get bigger, and they get bigger. And that's the picture that he's giving here. The tongue, though it's small, starts huge forest fires, so to speak. Anytime that there's a problem between believers, the tongue is probably a vital part of it. And so James is here depicting the tremendous power and the tremendous difficulties that are created by the tongue. In the course of our life, the tongue can inflame anything and anyone around us. As he speaks in verses 7 and 8, "Although man has sovereignty over every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea, has been tamed and has been tamed by mankind, but no one can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison." I take it seriously. James says no one can bring the tongue under control. He has here said it's impossible. And I think James means it. Remember, though, earlier in the chapter, he said that if anyone has his tongue under control, in verse 2 of chapter 3, the person is mature. But here he said no one can bring it under control. Is he telling us no one can be mature? Yes, he is. He's saying no one can be mature. Not in our own strength. The Christian way of life is an impossible life by our power. This is why we cannot take issues of sin and of learning the Word and of applying the Word by the power of the Spirit or of us praying. We cannot take those for granted. We need God's assistance. Without it, we are trying to do what is absolutely impossible. That's why it's important that we keep short accounts on our lives and we recognize, okay, I have sinned, and we confess that to the Lord. If we don't do that as it comes up in our lives, do we get cleansed? No. If we aren't being cleansed, how much profit are we getting out of trying to walk the Christian walk in our own power? We need that which God alone can provide in order that we can live the Christian way of life. James is saying man cannot bring his tongue under control, but God through his word can. Therefore, God through his word can bring about maturity. Should that be surprising that James would approach it that way? Well, I'm glad you asked. Take a look back at James chapter 1, verse 18. Of my own will I decided to be brought forth. Funny, James 1, 18 doesn't say that. He's talking about regeneration, and it's by the power of God. If the baby can't be born apart from God, that is, if regeneration can't happen apart from God, then how can growth take place apart from God? If the rebirth, the free gift of everlasting life through simply believing Christ's promise of everlasting life to us, results in God regenerating us, then we have to recognize that the Christian way of life is not something that we can bring about our own maturity. God, through his word, needs to be at work. Now, I'm making quite a point of this, as I did last week, because a lot of people have an idea that James just basically is saying, oh, do, you know, just keep on doing things and you'll bring about your own maturity. James isn't saying that. The way that James is looking at this is that God, through his word, is like that rider of the horse. We've got the bit in our mouth, and God is gently directing us through his word. What happens to us? We get the bit in our mouth, and we say, God made me sin. God tempted me. Remember how chapter 1 talked about that problem? He said, let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. We find it so easy to step away from that which God is doing through his word, that which he desires to do in us. And the only way that we're going to be able to grow, the only way that we're going to be able to please God is through his power being realized in us. Now, when he speaks in chapter 3, verse 7 about taming, it's really not the idea of taming. How many alligators, how many kinds of reptiles have been tamed? But he says all kinds of them have been. He's not talking about being tamed. He's talking about we exercise sovereignty over them. But in the same way, the tongue is something that needs us to ride herd on it. We need God's word to keep it under control. In verse 9, he talks about the unruliness of the tongue. Look at how, contrary to nature, it blesses God and curses man that God created in his image. Well, if we curse God's creation, aren't we cursing God? We don't tend to think about that when we gripe and we complain and we malign people. But that's the way God is looking at it. The tongue is unruly. Man cannot control it. And then, in verses 10 through 12, he talks about how You've got wonderful Buell Spring water. And out of that Buell Spring, Buell, Minnesota, Buell water, famous Buell water, you're only going to find good water. You're not going to find good water one day and salt water the next, or good water one day and bitter water the next. Look at how he puts it. Does a spring, let's see, out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing? My brethren, these things ought not be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? And then drop down to the last part of verse 12. No spring yields both salt water and fresh. One or the other, but look at what our tongue does contrary to nature. And then by extension, he also illustrates by looking at a fig tree, an olive tree, and grapes. And to some degree, the fruit can look similar from a distance. But a fig tree cannot bear olives. Grapevine cannot bear figs. And so he's saying, completely different kinds of trees, you're not going to be able to get this kind of fruit from that kind of tree. And he's saying, our tongue should only have one kind of fruit. It should have that which pleases the Lord. Okay, that's review of what we have considered thus far from last week in review. Let's take a look now, starting at verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. The point that James is making here is that believers are to manifest godly wisdom through applying the word. This is the only way that we can manifest the source of our wisdom. What we do in life is how we manifest our wisdom. Now, let's think back to the outline statement of the book. Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath. Where do we get wisdom? We get it from the Word. But how do we get it? How do we get that wisdom from the Word? Is it automatic? If I am praying at night and I put my nose down here in the Bible and I go to sleep on it, and I wake up with a crease on my face because my face has been resting in my Bible all night, how much wisdom am I going to get out of His Word? Not much. How did James say that we get the wisdom from the Word? Asking and believing. James chapter 1. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Goody, goody, another trial. Okay, no, he's not saying that we're necessarily going to enjoy the trial, but he's saying we can rest assured that God is using the trial to produce what we need in our life. So the reason that we should count it all joy is because we know that the testing of our faith produces patience. But let patience have its mature work, that you may be mature and complete, lacking nothing. Okay, what am I likely to be lacking as I go into this test? Wisdom. I probably don't know how to pass it. That's why it's a test. The tests that were really hard for me 5 years ago, hopefully I know a few things, and if I'm hit with the same test, hopefully I'll do a little better than I might have done 5 years ago. But as I'm facing a new test, what do I need? I need wisdom for how to face this trial. I lack something. I lack wisdom. So, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives only to a few people. He gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him. Well, doesn't that sound like a contradiction from what he says in verse 7? Let not that man suppose he will receive anything from the Lord. If the Lord gives it to everyone, why doesn't everyone get it? Well, they might not ask, or they might ask with the wrong motives, being double-minded, as he speaks here in verse 6. Let him ask in faith, with no doubting, for he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. God has given to everyone the wisdom here in the Word. But not everyone receives the wisdom that's in the Word. We pray for wisdom. Notice how we do that every time before we open up for Bible study. We need to be praying for wisdom from God's Word on a consistent basis in our lives. I hope that this is not the only time that you pray for wisdom. You know, we start Bible class and we pray for wisdom from His Word. But we need His wisdom all the time. We need it from His Word. He gives it to everyone, but if we are not properly prepared for it, we don't receive the wisdom that He has given to us. Okay, let's go back to chapter 3. Who is wise and understanding among you? Well, that's someone who's been praying for wisdom, believing that God will give the answer, and who is open to the Word, which means this is a person who is swift to hear. And the person who's swift to hear is going to be also swift to apply the truth that they believed. Let's think about that. What happened in chapter 1, verses 21 through 27? There he talked about, don't just be hearers of the Word, but be doers of the Word. Okay, he's talking about being swift to hear, but he's also talking about being swift to apply. Then in chapter 2, verses 1 through 13, he talks about not holding our faith with an attitude of partiality. So we have learned truth, we have faith, that things that we've learned, but we are to approach it in an impartial way. Not being stingy against people for reasons that don't count. And then, in chapter 2, verses 14 through 26, if we believe the Word, we are to do it. Faith and works. So, the way that someone becomes wise and understanding is by praying for wisdom, believing that God will give the answer, and they study the Word, and they apply it. And lo and behold, look at what it says in the second half of the verse. Let him show by his good notebook and his content that he has filled it up with how wise he is. Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. This is the only way that we can manifest the source of our wisdom. If our wisdom has come from the Word that God has supplied as we lack wisdom, and we study His Word, believing that He will teach us, we can only manifest, we can only show our wisdom through how we apply it. How many times have we seen someone who knows a lot of information that they've learned from the Bible, but they are very argumentative and they pick fights with everybody? Ever run into anyone like that? James is saying that there's only one way to be sure whether what we're doing is reflecting God's wisdom, and that's how we conduct our lives. Now, how were James's readers, some of them, trying to display their wisdom? I want to teach, I want to teach, I want to teach. And remember James said, let not many of you become teachers. He said, slow down, hold on, wait. And he was urging them not to be running ahead of God. He was not saying, let not any of you, but he was saying, don't run ahead of God in terms of what you want to do. So, how slow should one be to speak? Well, remember James 1:19, which said, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak. James is saying, don't let your speaking run ahead of your hearing. You know, he didn't talk about being slow to speak first. It's let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak. So, how slow should we be to speak? We make sure that our swift to hear and apply the word is ahead of our speaking. Okay? So in other words, that's where the priority is to be. Let's make sure that we're using the word that we have learned, that we believe the truth and apply it. And as we catch up with where we are on that, okay, that's all right. But let's not run way out in front of God. So in other words, he's set up this book in a very practical way to help us not run out in front of God. Okay, in verses 14 through 16, he speaks of bitter envy and self-centeredness. And he does so, uses those terms more than once. Verses 14 through 16. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. Notice how he begins in verse 14 with bitter envy and self-seeking, and he touches the same things in verse 16 as he wraps it up. So the argument as he sets it forth is that bitter envy and self-centeredness demonstrate that one's wisdom did not come from God, but instead is worldly and demonic. That's verses 14 and 15. But verse 16 gives an explanation that it produces confusion and all manner of evil. So, this is the opposite of the good conduct that was mentioned in verse 13. How many people, can you imagine, were clamoring to get up on top of someone else and say, okay, well, I should be teaching, not this person, and here's why. That person has this problem, and lo and behold, you can imagine how the tongue was going because people were wanting to climb up over each other. They were stepping on each other along the way. This was a very unruly congregation. James is writing to a group of people who have a lot of problems, and I guarantee you, we have just gotten started on their problems. I mean, they really get to be something else by the time we finish up chapter 5. But this self-centeredness and a willingness to just stomp on other people, does it make sense now as we look at how James talked in chapter 2, verses 1 through 13, where that person comes in who doesn't have as thick a wallet and they say, yeah, you can sit way back here, you can be as far away from the food line and from the Bible teaching, you can be outside, you know, that's fine with me. They really could care less. They're very focused on themselves. And what he's saying is such things do not demonstrate God's wisdom, but it's a wisdom that comes from demonic and earthly sources. And furthermore, such things tend to be contagious. When one person is out of control with their tongue, have you ever noticed that other people tend to get out of control with their tongues? And then other people, and other people, and it kind of grows. Have you ever noticed that an argument has a way of getting louder and louder and louder instead of starting out here and then getting quieter? James is talking about the unruliness that develops from the unruly tongue being allowed to go in its own direction. And he says it creates chaos. Well, fortunately, James gets back into some good news. Fortunately, it's a little more pleasant to read. Verse 17, but the wisdom that is from above. Remember back in James 1:17, what he said? Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above. It comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. God gives good gifts. He illustrated with the gift of regeneration in verse 18. But what he's saying is, we can't say temptation comes from God, because God only gives good gifts. And James is saying here, the kind of wisdom that God gives is a good gift. The kind of wisdom that He gives is pure. There's not any taint. It's peaceable. Now, peaceable and gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy. That sounds like a doormat, doesn't it? No. When you look at James, does James seem like a doormat? No way. He talks about dealing with the horse, having the bit in the mouth, having the bridle, having control, directing its head, and it going the way you want. He's talking about God working through gentle persuasion, but if necessary, the plow rain is fine. James is talking about God's word and the wisdom that comes from it is going to be gracious. Peaceable, not trying to provoke problems, having a gentleness, being able to deal with people where they are and not putting expectations upon them that are harsh, being willing to yield. If it's something that can be compromised on and it doesn't cause a problem, it's all right. Full of mercy and good fruits. Time out. Application of the word. Without partiality, without hypocrisy. But he's not saying that that wisdom is not firm. The wisdom is firm. It stands up for what is right. But it's not going to insist upon all the little selfish things that we're inclined to want to insist upon. And notice he's built up on most of these with truth that he's talked about earlier in the book. Gentleness. You can look back at chapter 1, verse 27. Let's take a look there. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble. That's a gentleness. And look at the mercy triumphing over judgment in 2:13. For judgment is without mercy to the one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. We want God to judge us harshly. He's saying, be harsh in our lives. Don't show mercy. If we want God to show mercy at the judgment seat, if we've been merciful, He'll say, I'll show mercy to you as well. Full of good fruits. 1:22 through 25 and 2:14 to 26 talk about that. Not being partial, 2:1 through 13. Not hypocritical. Notice 3:14. Everything that James is talking about here is the truth that happens and controls our tongue. That happens because we've been swift to hear the word and to apply it. Even applying it to our tongue. And then verse 18, which I didn't get into the notes. The fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Does that verse seem odd? Have you ever sown fruit? Of course. What's the fruit of a tomato plant? Tomatoes. What's in a tomato? Seeds. So you sow tomato seeds. Okay. What's the fruit of a corn plant? Corn. Ever plant corn? Ah. Isn't this interesting? Righteousness is both a fruit and a seed. It's something that is produced by the Word, but as righteousness is lived out in our lives, righteousness tends to affect those around us, and it's a planting of righteousness. People who make peace are not doormats. People who make peace are firm in the things that they need to be firm on, but are able to bend on the things that they need to bend on. It's like the peacemaker, that B-36. Because it was there, even though the Soviets had developed the atomic bomb, they were afraid to use it because they knew that we were ready to meet them. And this is making peace through strength. It isn't depicting the idea of, okay, we'll conquer everybody and that way we don't have anyone that can fight against us. But it's the idea of being able to have the strength in order to be able to be gracious. Look what happened during the era of time that this plan was being developed. The Marshall Plan was in force, and MacArthur was working at rebuilding Japan. The way that the United States dealt with the world was grace with strength. That's what James is talking about. If we have a position of strength from knowing what the Word says and we prayed for God's wisdom, we can be gracious in our dealings with others. But if we run out in front of God, then our mouth tends to get the better of us. James tells us that we do not have the capacity ourselves to control our tongue. But God, through His Word, is able to direct our heads with that bit and the bridle, so long as we don't get the bit in our mouth and require God to use the plow rein to get us to halt so we can start once again.